From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up where we ended on our previous broadcast and present more of an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank is talking with Neil Thomas, author of the new book, Taking Leave of Darwin, A Longtime Agnostic Discovers the Case for Design. Let's now join Hank Hanegraaff and Professor Thomas in their conversation.
So many people today are saying that the intelligent design theorists, they're smuggling religion into the picture under the banner of scientific credibility. And nothing could be farther from the truth. There's an epigraph in your book that says, if the world's finest minds can unravel only with difficulty the deeper workings of nature, how could it be supposed that those workings are merely a mindless accident, a product of blind chance? That's said by theoretical physicist Paul Davies. So
yes.
The point I want to drive at here is that in very many cases, the working of nature cannot be unraveled, and Darwin and later biologists have tended to paper over the cracks of their own knowledge, as opposed to taking seriously the possibility of intelligent design. And I bring this up in this capacity because I felt that your book was quite honest in this regard, that you opened up the doorway to intelligent design being not something that is speculative, but something that is warranted by the evidence.
Yes, I do think that. I mean, what I said in the book was really, since the evidence can be a bit elusive and ambiguous in many cases, I said that, you know, the old idea of nescience, which was a word used in the early modern period of English, but for meaning we do not know, and it didn't mean ignorance, just meant we do not know, was one possible way of going. But one has to admit that at the end of the day, if you're looking at the empirical evidence, and this is what a number of scientists have brought out far better than I could, then I think that the indices concerning complexity really trump the idea of nescience. I think there must be some kind of actuating force and indeed intelligence behind such things. I am not in a position to say what that intelligence might be any more than the great theologian Thomas Aquinas was in the early 13th century, or than the English mystics, the English mystic who wrote The Cloud of Unknowing, which sort of brought onto the agenda the kind of negative or apophatic theology by which you can derive a notion of a superior power, but you cannot necessarily fill in the gaps or say of what precise nature that superior power is. I think this is an open question, logically speaking, but again, logically speaking, I think there's a case for saying that such an entity must exist.
I think if you had a good long conversation with your wife, as Darwin probably should have had with Emma, maybe some of these mysteries can be cleared up.
But anyway.
You know, you got to listen to your wife, right? You know, I want to bring up a few things in this regard. I mean, when we're talking about intelligent design, and you bring them up in the book, language. The kind of obfuscation that people in the scientific community have made with respect to language, I think, is unworthy of their prowess academically. How can you explain away the complex linguistic capacities and say that these complex linguistic capacities evolved from ape-like communication? I mean, that's one of the most amazing things that is still communicated in the academy, and we should certainly know better at this stage of human history.
Yeah, I mean, I think this, again, is a very strange and problematical facet. As early as the 1860s themselves, just after Darwin's writings began to be known, there was a then renowned Oxford professor of Indo-European philology called Friedrich Max Müller, who said that he felt that human communication, since it is not dependent on simple onomatopoeic grunts, that is, which suggests mood, not any more advanced intellectual content, that is, you could not extrapolate from that the kind of hyper-sophisticated language that you and I are using now could have possibly derived from an ape-like ancestor. I mean, Darwin himself, in The Descent of Man, says that, maybe some ape ended up, he doesn't say how, with a superior brain, and that this was passed on. Well, you know, this is pure conjecture, and there is absolutely no line of causation between the kind of linguistic capacities that you and I have and what our ape-like cousins, as they say, have. Also, this is a point that actually was brought up more recently by the renowned linguist Noam Chomsky, when he said, I don't know whether he was taking issue with Darwinism as such, but he stated that human communication was a very complex kind, and that it might indeed be inborn in the human infant, so that, for instance, you can talk in English or Chinese or whatever language, but the ability to do so is somehow inborn. Therefore, how did it become inborn if it isn't inborn in our simian cousins? The line of transmission from simian to human is huge. Darwin would call it a saltation, a huge leap, a leap of faith to think that any simian grunts and groans could ever have formed the basis of the human language.
Yeah, I mean, we were hardwired for grammar from birth. And that's hard to explain through the evolutionary process, as is the sophistication of the human brain, which I thought you did a terrific job of explicating in your book.
I think it was Michael Denton who did the explicating. I gave a very lengthy quote from him, which I think was marvelous. I don't see how anybody can counter it, to be honest. It was so marvelous.
Yeah, I think what is written in your book in this regard, when you think about the awe-inducing complexity of the human brain,
yes,
no kind of hyperbole can do it justice. And I've tried to explain this in various venues, but I, again, think that, with the quotes that you have and so forth, but you're pulling it all together. You've done a marvelous job in your book. You've made a great contribution by the way you banded it all together, so that people can see just how impossible it is to suppose that natural selection and common descent can in some way account for the sophistication of the human brain. You also, I think, have done a great job and a great service of demonstrating substance dualism, that the mind and the brain are separate entities. I mean, how do you explain what people can explain today, how the mind can cause the physical synapses of the brain to fire in the first place?
That is a mystery, yes.
It is a mystery, and it is a mystery that I think evolutionists ought to take seriously. I mean, a lot of people are physicalists, and they say the physical facts fix all the facts, but I don't think you can say that in an age of scientific enlightenment.
I don't think you can. A book I've been reading recently by a neurologist called Donald Hoffman, 1F, 2Ns, Donald Hoffman, it's something called Darwinism and the Denial of Reality, or something like that. I've got it here somewhere. And Hoffman, he worked together with Francis Crick, who was the, as you know, the co-discoverer of DNA. And this could only have been in the latter decades of the 20th century, because Crick is not alive any longer. And Crick said more or less, he was rather a sort of buccaneering sort, as I understand it. I've cracked DNA, now I'm going to crack the brain and consciousness. And of course, he didn't get anywhere near doing so, because, to use a word you've used, the physicalist conception of what the brain consists in does not really hit the mark when you're talking about these ultra subtle responses that human beings have. In fact, Hoffman quotes somebody else who said that if you look at the physical aspects of the brain, to say that you can somehow deduce from that or postulate from that the whole panoply of human thought and emotion is like saying you can derive numbers from biscuits or ethics from rhubarb. You know, the two are incommensurable. There's a whole dimension that we don't know of in the brain. Just as about 96% of the outer cosmos represents dark energy and dark matter, so I would say more than 96% of the brain is totally inscrutable to us.
In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank's conversation with Professor Neil Thomas. In the new book, Taking Leave of Darwin, University Professor Neil Thomas writes, "What if Charles Darwin got it wrong? What if all the crises, alienations, and losses of faith we associate with the aftermath of the publication of The Origin of Species had been triggered by a false prospectus? What if the latent but ever-present hostilities between science and religion of the last 160 years had been fomented on the equivalent of a dodgy dossier?" Thomas was a committed Darwinist and agnostic until an investigation of evolutionary theory led him to the conclusion that design is not only possible, but indeed is presently the most reasonable explanation for the origin of life's great diversity of forms. To receive your copy of Taking Leave of Darwin, A Longtime Agnostic Discovers the Case for Design by Neil Thomas, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit us at equip.org. That's equip.org.
University Professor Neil Thomas was a committed Darwinist and agnostic until an investigation of evolutionary theory led him to the startling conclusion that he had been conned. As he studied the work of Darwin's defenders, he found himself encountering tactics eerily similar to the methods of political brainwashing he had studied as a scholar. Thomas felt impelled to write a book as a sort of warning call to humanity. Beware, you have been fooled. The result is Taking Leave of Darwin, a fascinating history and analysis of the evolution debate, written in exquisite prose. Thomas shows that objections to evolutionary theory raised by Darwin's own contemporaries have never been effectively answered. To receive your copy of Taking Leave of Darwin, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit us at equip.org. That's equip.org.
Bertrand Russell famously said, "Most people would rather die than think, and many of them do." Not so with CRI support team members. Support team members are not only serious thinkers, but their membership in CRI's support team helps to equip hundreds of thousands of fellow believers around the globe each and every month. Are you not a member? Then you're missing out. Not only do support team members form the backbone of Christian Research Institute's outreaches, but they enjoy their selection of resources from our Equipping Essentials library and receive a complimentary subscription to CRI's award-winning Christian Research Journal, just two of the benefits of membership. To discover how you can make a difference 24/7 in equipping believers at home and abroad to stand for life and truth, check out the benefits of membership at equip.org.
Hank Hanegraaff has dedicated his life to defending truth because truth matters. Yet an encounter with Christians in the underground church of China left Hanegraaff contemplating his Christian experience. They were experiencing something beyond truth. They were experiencing life. Truth Matters, Life Matters More by Hank Hanegraaff is two books in one. Because Truth Matters, Part 1 equips Christians to defend the essential truths of the historic Christian faith. In Part 2, Hank explains why life matters more and how we can experience the height of human existence, union with God. Prepare to move past intellectually knowing about God to experientially knowing God in Christ. To receive your copy of Truth Matters, Life Matters More, The Unexpected Beauty of an Authentic Christian Life, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit us at equip.org.
Let's rejoin Bible Answer Man host Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, Professor Neil Thomas, in their conversation.
Something that you bring out in the book is Alfred Russel Wallace, who was a contemporary of Darwin.
Yes,
in
yes.
In fact, he might have beat Darwin to the punch with publication, but didn't.
Mm-hmm.
He had a conversion experience from naturalism to intelligent design, much like you have had.
Mm-hmm.
But this was based on the idea that not only humanity, but the entire cosmos had been intelligently crafted. You discuss in the book what ignited that change. So you have Wallace parting company with Darwin on the subject of the human mind. He cited his inability to comprehend how unconscious processes should be able to produce consciousness. So mm-hmm. he was, as I was talking about before, he was convinced that the mind and the body were really distinct and discrete entities. And so he had a conversion experience as well. He went in one direction, Darwin continued in the other direction, although, as you have pointed out, he was very confused and confabulated in his own writing about this.
Yes. Further to writing the book, I've had some more thoughts and more research to do about Wallace. He was a totally different kettle of fish. I mean, you've got to remember with Wallace, he did not have a background such as Darwin had. I mean, I'm talking about Darwin's grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, who was the foremost person to put forward the idea of evolution in England. And Darwin, I feel, all the more so because he didn't always give credit to his grandfather as much as he should have, felt himself somehow in a sort of family competition that he had to find the answer to this $64,000 question as to how evolution could occur. And once he felt or he fancied that he'd found it, he had to cling to it like for grim death. Now, Wallace was a totally different sort of person. He was simply an intelligent young man without any great means. He came of a rather impoverished family, a sort of impoverished, genteel kind of background in a way. And he had a tremendous interest in life in the greater sense. I mean, for instance, I mean, when Darwin bowed out of public affairs in around about 1870, he devoted himself to this rather safe exploration of barnacles. Well, Wallace, of course, became a public intellectual. He made some really distinctive contributions to cosmology. And in a way, what had happened in his earlier life was a previous chapter, and he did not feel the same sense of family territory to be defended at whatever cost, because his grandfather had not been distinguished evolutionist and so on. So he was, I think, more open-minded. And I think also, when you say he had a conversion experience, I would say that that conversion experience came rather slowly, because at one time he indulged in a kind of dualism, didn't he? He said that the body could be the result of natural selection, but the mind certainly couldn't be. And, you know, he was arraigned at the time for so-called dualism, for, you know, this stark distinction between the mind and the body. And it was only later in life, and remember, he lived from 1913, right out of his era in a way, it was only latterly that he was prepared to concede that the whole of the created order must have had a creator in that sense.
You know, one of the things I want to talk about is the ramifications of social Darwinism. Three particular categories: racism, sexism, and eugenics. The racism of Darwin's theory, pretty pronounced. In The Descent of Man, for example, he speculated that at some future period, not very distant as measured by centuries, the civilized races of man will almost certainly exterminate and replace the savage races throughout the world. And
yes, he wasn't advocating it. He was just saying that it was a fait accompli, that it was something natural, wasn't he? I understand.
Yeah, although in many senses, I mean, this whole idea of racism was advocated, if you look at the history of evolution, it was advocated many venues, and I can talk about that in a few minutes, but I want to leave that for just a moment and just augment what I said about racism with sexism. Mm-hmm. Darwin was very clearly a sexist. He viewed women as essentially less perfectly evolved versions of men.
Yes.
He famously said that the chief distinction in the intellectual powers of the two sexes is shown by men attaining to a higher eminence in whatever a man takes up than can a woman, and that the average of mental power in man must be above that of women. And then with respect to eugenics, Darwin's subjective spin, I think, led to that nightmare. The idea that the gene pool was being corrupted by the less fit genes of inferior people began to have widespread support. It was supported by the National Academy of Sciences, the American Medical Association. Mm-hmm. It was funded by Carnegie and Rockefeller. It was supported even by presidents like Teddy Roosevelt. And with this idea of eugenics, I mean, you had the notion that the gene pool was being corrupted by the less fit genes of inferior people. And in order to thwart that unfortunate condition, you had to get rid of those people. And so eugenics became a blight on civilization, but it followed, in my perspective at least, naturally from the theory of evolution.
Yes, I think you're right. It's not something I adverted to directly in the book, except in the sense that I said that the sociobiology that we associate with the 1970s, with E.O. Wilson and so on, has been arraigned for precisely the kind of divisiveness and racialism and sexism, even Nazism, some people have said, or quasi-Nazism. And I wouldn't wish to dissent from that. In fact, in my own family background, I mean, my maternal grandparents were part of the farming community in the 1930s. And of course, they were used to looking at things from a reductionist animal point of view. And I know that my late mother said that my grandfather, for instance, in the 1930s, was quite an admirer of Hitler, and that eugenics seemed to be a perfectly logical way of arranging human affairs. So I think that there is a line, as you say, especially from The Descent of Man, where Darwin speculates rather more freely than he did in his original Origin of Species about things, especially about human life. I think that there is a straight line from Darwin and to such later developments. The strange thing is, and one of the things I'm looking at the moment, I'll just put this in parenthesis, is I've begun to be interested in the way that sociobiology has been excoriated so much, and yet Darwinism has remained untouched by many critical voices that you would otherwise think would criticize it more. It seems to be a sort of inconsistency, since we've already established, I think, that the two are indissolubly linked, intellectually speaking.
I don't think there's any question about that. I mean, I'm thinking about the 20th century in which eugenics was standard fare in high school biology classes. And the classic example, and you actually allude in your book to the 1925 Scopes monkey trial, but you have George William Hunter's textbook, A Civic Biology. I think we ought to note very carefully, because this is the infamous biology text at the center of that trial. John Scopes used that very text to convince impressionable students that humanity has an evolutionary hierarchy, that at present time there exist upon the earth five races or varieties of man. And then the text makes a stirring case for the pseudoscience of eugenics, goes so far as to say that the remedy for those not well born should be extermination. So again, the idea is an idea that had real significance, certainly in America, with this civic biology text.
Yes, I think, I mean, of course, you can draw a line to the Nazi extermination camps and to the forced sterilization endeavors which took place in the United States earlier in the 20th century as well. Yes, I think that these were intellectually coherent from a Darwinian perspective, yes.
You have some delicious monikers in your book, including materialistic magic. You use that word magic several times in the book. Talk about the materialistic magic that's part and parcel of the Darwinian paradigm.
Well, I think it really goes back to whether you think that things can emerge by some kind of occult automatism, as in magic shows for children and adults, even to the modern day, or if you feel obligated to be able to put your finger on exactly the process or the mechanism which causes these things in the first place.
We'll have to stop here for today's edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Join us again next time when we'll continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Professor Neil Thomas, a committed Darwinist and agnostic, until an investigation of evolutionary theory led him to a startling conclusion that he had been fooled. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand CRI's mind-shaping outreaches, Hank would like to send you Neil Thomas's book, Taking Leave of Darwin, A Longtime Agnostic Discovers the Case for Design. Call a resource consultant at 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or visit our website, equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more.
University professor Neil Thomas was a committed Darwinist and agnostic until an investigation of evolutionary theory led him to the startling conclusion that he had been conned. As he studied the work of Darwin's defenders, he found himself encountering tactics eerily similar to the methods of political brainwashing he had studied as a scholar. Thomas felt impelled to write a book as a sort of warning call to humanity. Beware, you have been fooled. The result is Taking Leave of Darwin, a fascinating history and analysis of the evolution debate, written in exquisite prose. Thomas shows that objections to evolutionary theory raised by Darwin's own contemporaries have never been effectively answered. To receive your copy of Taking Leave of Darwin, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit us at equip.org. That's equip.org.